Good morning, everyone. Thank you very much for joining us this first Tuesday of June, and welcome to the Tax Resolution Institute's Practitioners Forum, part of our Tax Tuesday series. As a reminder, our Practitioners Forum happens every first Tuesday of the month, and our next call will be on July 3rd, so please mark your calendars. Yes, I am aware that a lot of you will be away on vacation for the 4th of July weekend, but we are going to have it on July 3rd. Before we get started, I want to remind everyone how these calls typically work. We notice that there's a lot of new, I want to say faces, but a lot of new participants to this month's call. So I want to make sure we reiterate this information. If you can hear the sound of my voice, then that means that you've logged in correctly. Because it can be difficult to moderate all participants we have on today, we asked for questions to be submitted via email, and a lot of you responded. After we answer those questions and time permitting, we will open it up to the rest of you on the line. We will announce when the question and answer session has begun and ask that you please type in the questions box your name as you entered it while logging onto the call and that you have a question. We will then unmute you and we will call upon you to ask your question. We will select participants in the order of when you submitted your name in the question box. Once we unmute you, you will be prompted by the system that you have been unmuted, and you will now be able to speak for all of us to hear. Now, past experience shows that a lot of you are a little gun-shy and don't want to come on and talk live, so feel free to ask your question in the question box and just go ahead and type that in. For that, it's first come, first serve, so you guys can go ahead and submit your questions now, and that way we can queue you up for the second half of the call. Okay, now that we got that out of the way, let's go ahead and begin. Joining us on the call today, we have the head of our legal department at the Tax Resolution Institute, Mr. Norman Kreisman. Norman is an expert on Chapter 7, 11, and 13, debtor and creditor representation, while specializing in the discharging of federal and state taxes. Norman received his BS at the Arizona State University and received his JD at Loyola Law School. Norman has represented both debtors and creditors, has a history of successful execution, and helps to identify and clarify legal issues for his clients. A seminar speaker on discharging taxes in bankruptcy, he has been admitted to practice before the U.S. Tax Court and Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. As the leader of the Tax Resolution Institute legal team, Norman is an invaluable resource both for his ability to communicate effectively with clients and his extensive experience working with the IRS and state taxation agencies. Ladies and gentlemen, Norman Kreisman.
Good morning. Be sure to check out TRI's Tax Tuesdays. Each Tuesday, TRI offers something great. Like today, on the first Tuesday of each month, this practitioner's call is offered. As you know, this is a great opportunity to have your tax resolution questions answered at no cost to you. On the second and fourth Tuesdays of each month, we offer Tax Tuesday lightning deals. Be sure to come back regularly as the offers change each time. Get free stuff, amazing discounts, and much more. And on the third Tuesday of each month, we broadcast our featured webinar. Learn audits, offers, installment agreements, appeals, and much more. If you forget what happens when, check out our courses calendar at www.taxresolutioninstitute.org/courses. And don't forget, we're here to teach you how to make more money, work with you on your tax resolution cases, and become your trusted referral source.
Thank you very much, Norman. Yes, everyone hang tight because we do have an announcement. Many of you know we do have our full-day seminar coming up in August, and I am going to offer you guys a special promo for that. Now, one of the things that I wanted to do a little bit differently than we have done in the past is we wanted to share recent successes with you folks so that you understand how these cases typically go, and we can share our experience, our hurdles, and what we had to do to be able to overcome some obstacles and eventually come with a win for the client. So, Norman, do you want to share the installment agreement that we just recently did?
So we had a couple who owed the IRS $282,000 and some change. It was assigned to a revenue officer. We work with revenue officer completing a Form 433A, which is a collection information statement. There were some hurdles in this case because the taxpayers had a home with equity and had money in a bank in another country. So there were some issues, but the bottom line was we got them into an installment agreement for $100 a month. So that would be a partial pay installment agreement, because at $100 a month, by the time the statute expires, which is 10 years from the date of assessment, they will only have paid a portion of the tax. In fact, because of interest, they probably owe more today than they did when we set up the installment agreement, but it doesn't really matter, because whatever the balance is at the time of the collection statute expiration date, all the tax that's been unpaid, including penalties and interest, will be forgiven and the lien will be released. So it's really $100 a month, and the IRS has left them alone for the last, it's been over 3 years now. So some of those years are going to start to drop off too. So they're really happy.
Yeah, and what makes that unique is we were dealing with both IRS and Franchise Tax Board at the same time. So doing same financials for two agencies worked in our favor, so we can streamline that process for the client. Now, one of the things that a lot of people on the call are looking for is, you know, a lot of these resolution cases seem to be transactional. But what you don't realize is that these taxpayers, whether they continue using us for their ongoing tax preparation or any other tax-related issue after we've resolved their IRS or state matter, will come back, especially since in this particular case, as Norman said, it's a partial pay installment agreement. The IRS is eventually going to want to revisit them and try to figure out if they can afford to pay more than $100, because they, remember, partial pay installment agreement is never permanent. They do reserve the right to come and revisit you to see if your financial condition has changed. But anyways, all right, so every month that we're going to try to pick a success story that happened recently and send those to and explain that to you guys and show you how that works. So now we're going to go ahead and get started with the questions that were submitted. As a reminder, the members, VIP members to our website, get priority during these calls. So this first set of questions is coming directly from members. So let's go ahead and start it off with Angie. Angie is a longtime caller, let's call her, and attends our forum regularly. And she's asking, I have an 85-year-old taxpayer who has IRS liability of $2,800 for 2015. This is per the transcript that she pulled. And Maryland, only about $500 left. She pays $50 a month. She told me IRS told her she owed $10,000. Maybe that's where she started. It was from an IRA distribution where no tax was withheld. She has $4,300 in the bank, and which is making the OIC calculation not go in her favor. She's on Social Security, about $1,700 a month, and gets an additional $500 a month in pension. If she were to spend down the savings over the next few months, would the IRS look at that as transferring the assets? I have her in CNC right now, and there are no more withholdings from the little pension, therefore no refund for them to keep. Just trying to keep this poor lady, give this poor lady a break from having to pay the rest of the liability and maybe even abate the penalty.
Well, there's a lot going on in this. First of all, I don't think that an offer is necessarily the best way to go all the time. So for instance, if the taxpayer is currently non-collectible status, I would say leave her in currently non-collectible and they only, look at it maybe every 2 years. So if, I don't know how long she's been in currently non-collectible, but if it's recently, that would buy another 2 years. And remember, being in currently non-collectible or being in a installment agreement does not toll the statute. So the clock is still ticking and eventually that tax will become uncollectible. Whereas if you submit an offer, the offer tolls the clock. And so the time from when the offer is submitted until the time the offer is either accepted or rejected plus 30 days because you have 30 days to object, the clock has stopped. So my first calculation would be just keep her in CNC and do nothing right now. Then if they come back and they want to an additional current 433F, you could do that and maybe put her back into currently non-collectible, because if she's pretty much has a fixed income of pension and Social Security, that's not going to change. And so if she's in currently non-collectible now, it seems to me in 2 years, she's still going to be in CNC, and you could pretty much run off the clock by putting her in CNC every 2 years. As to the money in the bank, yeah, they may treat that as a dissipated asset if you were to submit an offer, unless you do an offer not as to doubt as to collectability, but there's a special case.
Effective administration.
Effective administration, which says if there's, for some reason, there's somebody that has an asset or equity in their home or some other reason that they shouldn't have to use that for the offer. And so maybe in this case, because of her age and because of her fixed income, you could argue that she needs the $4,300 as a backup for unexpected expenses or whatever, and file that kind of offer, effective tax administration offer. The other thing too is there's something about paying $50 a month. I mean, the lowest the IRS will accept is $25 a month. So if you had to pay something, maybe you can get it down to $25. But in the meantime, I wouldn't be spending a lot of time or money contemplating an offer on a liability of $2,800. I would just worry about keeping her in currently non-collectible or a very small monthly payment until the statute expires.
Yeah, it's good advice there, because one of the things, this particular case has a lot of things going for her, her fixed income, her age, but the one thing that's not working in her favor is the liability amount itself. It's very difficult to prove to the IRS that any taxpayer can't pay $2,800 on the remaining statute of limitation. In this particular case, it looks like it might be 7, 8, 9 years away.
Especially when they have more money in the bank than they owe.
Right.
So an offer would be rejected because they would say that she has the ability to full pay.
To full pay, correct. So yes, so I agree with Norman. It's going to be keep it CNC status or a very low dollar installment agreement and keep the IRS offer back. All right, Angie, hopefully that answered your question there. Moving on to another member here. This is Jesse. Jesse's asking, can taxes be discharged if the client did not file their own returns and the IRS filed SFRs?
Okay, so by discharge, I imagine you're referring to bankruptcy. And if that's the case, then the answer is no. SFRs are not dischargeable in bankruptcy. A client has to file their own return, and there's a split in the different circuits as whether or not filing a return after the IRS prepares an SFR is adequate as filing their own return and being able to be discharged after 2 years, because remember you have to wait 2 years from the filing of a return. And so in some states you could file a return and wait 2 years and discharge it. In others you cannot. Once the IRS prepares an SFR, then that means that that year's tax liability will never be dischargeable in bankruptcy.
All right, Jesse, hopefully that answers that question. And again, Norman is a bankruptcy attorney, so if you need to use some of that consultation time to pick his brain a little bit more, give us a call or send us a request, and we'll schedule that for you. Moving on to Arthur, another member, he's saying, when a lien is placed on real estate, do subsequent interest and penalties get added to that lien?
The answer is yes and no. And by that I mean, yes, that added interest and penalties would be attached to that lien, but also payments would be go towards lowering the amount on the lien. So the lien is just a fixed document that's recorded with the county recorder that attaches to real property in the county on giving notice that the taxpayer owes taxes for that year. But then if the taxpayer was either to sell the house or refinance or otherwise try to take equity out of the house, then the escrow company would do a title search and they would see that there was a tax lien and they would see the year that the tax lien is attached to, and they would request that the IRS put a demand in escrow, and then the IRS would put a demand, they would do a calculation and see how much tax was owed at the time of the recording of the lien, and then how much has it been paid down, or has interest gone up and nothing has gone towards lowering it, and the IRS would put a demand in escrow for the amount that's owed on that year's taxes in order to get that lien paid off. But the document itself isn't modified for the life of the lien. It's just a notice, and a demand has to be put through to determine how much is left on it. Just like a mortgage. They record a mortgage for the amount, and you know, it might be a 30-year mortgage, but if you sold your house, the mortgage company would put a demand in escrow for the amount, for the balance due, and the balance might be more or less than the amount of the original mortgage.
All right. Thank you, Norman, for that. Moving on to the next one here, also a member, Ruby's asking, how does one know when the CSED begins and ends? Where do you find it on the transcripts?
So the CSED, which is collection statute expiration date, begins on the date of assessment. So when you look on the IRS transcript, I'm talking about the account transcript, it would say that the date that the return was filed and then the date that the tax was assessed is usually like 6 weeks later or so, because it takes the IRS some time to post and then process that return. And so it would be 10 years from the date that the tax was assessed, unless you'd have to look at the transcript and see if there were any tolling events like appeals or offers or pending installment agreements or bankruptcies, or if the taxpayer was out of the country for more than 6 months. Those are all events that would toll the statute. But the statute expiration date does not appear on the transcript. So you have to figure it out, or what I do is when I order the transcript, I ask the person at ACS that I'm speaking to on the phone, what's the CSED, and they'll give it to me. Also, if you have certain programs like we do, it figures out the CSED for you and takes in the tolling events and tells you what the CSED is.
All right. Thank you very much, Norman, for that. One of the things that I also noticed on the transcripts is I think it tells you when the assessment date is on the returns.
When it's assessed, there's a series of numbers under the assessment, and that sometimes, but not always, is the CSED date. But you can't go by that either, because that's based on 10 years from assessment. It doesn't take into account if there's any subsequent tolling events.
Got it. All right, moving on to the next member here is Eric. Eric is asking, taxpayer has unfiled returns for 10 plus years and has been self-employed for most of that time. He worked a couple of jobs where they issued W-2s and now received a letter from the IRS asking to file 15 and 16. Will the IRS be asking for all the delinquent returns? Client has already indicated records are almost non-existent for that period of time.
They may not, because the other years may not have what's called the filing requirements. And that's because what I would do is order the wage and income transcript, and you can see. So if they're self-employed, then the only way that the IRS would know that they meet the filing requirement would be if they received W-2s or 1099s. But if they didn't receive any 1099s or W-2s for a year, then the IRS has no knowledge that they had any income and may not be required to file a return. So I would go ahead and file the 2015 and 16. I would ask, first I would order wage and income transcripts so that you can make sure that you have an idea of what W-2s and 1099s the taxpayer received so that you don't forget any sources of income. And you might want to order wage and income transcripts for the other years too. And you might see that either they didn't have any W-2s or 1099s or anything indicating any income, or if they did, that it was a small amount and didn't reach the filing requirement.
All right. Thank you very much, Norman, for that. Moving on to another member, Daniel, is asking, I just joined and have been watching the videos you made available to me. Wanted to take advantage of the forum and ask a simple question. What if a client doesn't have any assets and no disposable income after completing the financials? Can you just make the offer for, let's say, $500?
Okay, if you're referring to IRS, the answer is yes. If the taxpayer really doesn't have any disposable income or any assets worth anything, then a $500 offer would be considered. California wouldn't work. They have a minimum, and they may not accept an offer simply based on disposable income and financials, but the IRS would. So yeah, I wouldn't have, if it worked out that way, then I wouldn't have a problem submitting an offer to the IRS for $500.
All right. Next one is coming from Frank. Frank is asking, will the IRS accept an OIC for liability stemming from payroll taxes? If so, is it the same criteria for an individual? Please elaborate.
Okay, so I can't tell from this question if by payroll taxes, you mean that a business is submitting the offer, and I don't know what the form of that business is. Is it a corporation or a partnership or an LLC? Or was it a sole proprietorship? Or is it an individual that was assessed trust fund recovery penalty from payroll taxes? So it's kind of hard to tell, but to answer your question the best I can based on the limited information I have, no, businesses are not treated the same as individuals. And there is such a thing as an in-business offer, where a business submits an offer for payroll tax liability, even though it's still operating. And there's certain questions about current compliance and other stuff, but there is an in-business offer that's possible to submit for payroll tax liability. And I don't know, again, I don't know here if an individual has been assessed trust fund recovery penalty or not, or what the form the entity takes that owes the payroll taxes. So based on that information, that's the best I can tell.
Okay. Next one is coming from Rob. Rob is asking, is there a maximum penalty amount that can be abated on the first-time penalty abatement program? Can the FTPA program be applied to both individuals and businesses? And then how difficult is it to deal with the IRS on an FTPA program?
As far as I know, there's no maximum penalty amount. We've requested first-time penalty abatement for some pretty large penalties. And yes, it can be applied to individuals and businesses. And it's not difficult because it's all fact-oriented. So when you call ACS and you say you want to apply the first-time penalty abatement program, then they'll ask you some questions. They'll input it in the computer. They'll look at the taxpayer's history to see if they've had been compliant for the prior 3 years or not. And they can tell you pretty much right then if they qualify or not. If they do, then the penalty will be abated. And if not, they'll tell you why not. And you may want to object and you may not. But they'll let you know right then. So it's not a hard thing. They do the determination for you.
All right. Moving on to Julie. Julie has a question about statistics from the IRS. Julie wants to know, as a percent, what percent of offers and compromise are accepted by the IRS? So we did a little digging and got these numbers straight from the IRS website. So for fiscal year 2016, there was approximately 63,000 offers submitted, and of those 63,000, only 27,000 were accepted. So it's about a little over 42% of the offers submitted that were actually accepted. For fiscal year 2017, numbers are very similar. Submitted was about $62,000 and accepted was $25,000. Sorry, I keep saying dollars. 62,000 submitted and accepted, 25,000 were accepted. So again, a little bit over 40, that one's 40% of offers submitted and were accepted.
Right, so the amount of acceptance for offers varies greatly between offers that are submitted by the taxpayer directly or those offers that have been submitted when the taxpayer is hired professional help. Like for instance, I think our success rate at offers is 90% or more, 90% plus. Now that doesn't necessarily mean that the offer is accepted by the offer specialist right off the bat. Sometimes the offer specialist has rejected our initial offer and we've appealed it directly to the offer specialist and gotten the offer specialist to change their mind and the offer's been accepted, or there's a little bit of haggling negotiation and the offer is finally agreed to at an amount slightly more than what the taxpayer had initially offered, but still doable. And sometimes we have to take it to appeals and a settlement officer reviews it, and we've had it where the offer is accepted by the settlement officer. So if you weren't familiar with the appeals process, you may not know all your rights and it may be difficult to appeal initial rejection. Also, if you didn't know exactly what the offer specialist looks at to determine whether or not to accept the offer, it might be a little bit tricky. So I would say that your chances of getting the offer accepted more than doubles if you have somebody doing it who knows what they're doing.
Right, and that leads me to my next comment here. And thank you, Julie, for that question, because one of the things that we emphasize is showing you the ropes, showing you from beginning to end how to be able to submit an offer, and you doing the initial analysis to determine the chances of getting that offer accepted. It's a lot of things to consider. There's a lot of steps to go through, and what a perfect time to address our upcoming event where we spend a significant amount of time going over offers in compromise coming up on August 1st. So I want to take this opportunity, give you a little bit of information about the event that's coming up, and then make that offer that I initially mentioned to you folks. So again, it is time for our next full day event. It's coming up on August 1st. With this course, you're going to learn how to make your most difficult clients your highest source of income, learn how to easily perform the work you dread the most, learn the tips and traps you need to make you a tax resolution expert. So we do have three different dates and times to accommodate the different time zones. So it's the Tax Resolution Essentials 200A Intermediate Tax Resolution coming up on August 1st. This is the live date. So we have, it's a Pacific Standard Time, 8 o'clock in the morning. You can attend live or also online. And then again, we're having a rebroadcast, two different dates to accommodate the other time zones. So, August 9th at 8 a.m. to accommodate the Eastern Standard Time, and August 10th at 8 a.m. Central, again, to accommodate those folks, in the Central. Typically this course, if you want to attend live and in person, is $300. If you want to attend online or through a webinar, it's $250. So as always, I have a promotion for you folks that are attending our practitioners forum. We want to make sure we take care of you and give you a good discount. If you sign up for the event, we're going to give you a discount of $50 on each of those price points. So for the live event, you will pay $250. For the webinar or the online, any of the days, it's going to be $200. But as a kicker, we're going to add, if you attend the event live, we're going to give you the Ultimate Guide to Tax Resolution textbook, which is $149 value. Add that to that if you purchase today. For those of you that are going to attend online, we'll give you the electronic version of it, a $99 value, so that you can also get the textbook, get the information to be able to help you grow your practice, become a TRI resolution expert, and help ensure that when you do submit an offer, you have a high probability of acceptance based on you taking the course, know what to look out for, what tips and traps. So again, go ahead. I'm pushing a link now. You will need a promo code. The promo code is FORUM50, but I'm going to push that here in the chat box. So go ahead and sign up today. We'll get you that special discount, and hope to see you in a couple of weeks. Sorry, a couple of months. Thank you very much for that. So let's go ahead and keep this ball rolling. Moving on to the other questions. This is coming from John. John, he's asking, have you used the online streamline installment agreement request form online for the IRS? I just tried it for one of my clients and it did not accept the payment I requested. I took their liability of $18,000 and divided it by 72 months and proposed $250. The system rejected it and said the minimum acceptable was $720. Why would that be?
So the reason is, I think that the streamline installment agreement is only for full pay agreements, so that the 72 months will full pay the liability before the statute expires, so that it would only work if the taxes that you were requesting the installment agreement for were longer. But if you had taxes that were more than 4 years old, then they wouldn't necessarily be paid off by the time that the 72 months expired. And so the reason that they want $720 a month is because it looks to me like some of the older years need to be paid off before they drop off. And that's where the $720 is required. So the way around that is not to do the streamline and to prepare a 433F and to call ACS and go over with them and set up a payment plan for what they can afford based on the 433F. And even if the amount that they propose doesn't pay off the tax liability within the statute, they can still go ahead. So you can do a partial pay through a 433F through ACS. But on the streamlined installment agreement online, you can only do full pay installment agreements.
All right. So there you go. Hopefully that explains it to you there, John, because it's always a mystery when the system rejects you and you're not sure why. Moving on to the next one is Mary. Mary says, I helped a friend of mine submit an OIC for a large liability. I believe they are basing their decision on information on his 2015 tax return. His situation has changed dramatically, and we feel he is a good candidate. Can you explain the appeals process for this type of case?
Okay, so when you got the letter rejecting the offer or saying that the taxpayer had the ability to full pay, you got like 30 days to object to it and send the reason why you disagree to the offer specialist, and they could relook at it. So if you've hopefully you've done that so that you don't use up your appeal rights and let them lapse. If the offer specialist won't budge and sticks to their guns that the taxpayer can full pay, then the case gets forwarded to appeals and you deal with an appeals officer or settlement officer. And again, you explain the reason why you disagree with the offer specialist and why you think that the offer you submitted is appropriate. I'm not sure what they based it on. It could be one of two things. If you look at the, they have an income and expense table, and either they've said that the taxpayer is receiving more income than you stated on your, in your offer, or they've rejected some of the expenses. And so that's increased the disposable income. So whatever reason is, you would have to look at why they said the taxpayer could full pay. And if you disagree, state the reasons why you disagree. And, but that, I don't think that they would base it on income for just 1 year. And if they did, you could ask for income averaging, and that's taking the last 3 years' income and dividing by three and coming up with an average. And that's a good way of working it if the taxpayer doesn't receive a steady income and the income fluctuates greatly between 1 year and another. And so if they had a particularly high income in 1 year, you would want to offset it by the lower income in the other years. So that's income averaging, and that's in the Internal Revenue Manual that instructs the offer specialist to look at the last 3 years.
All right. Thank you, Norman, for that. Moving on to Matthew. Matthew's asking, if an offer is submitted and received by the IRS, confirmation letter received, will they now be able to receive a refund if they file a return? We've been waiting to file their 17 return because of this.
No, the part of the offer is that the IRS will seize any refunds for the year that the offer's accepted. So if they've been waiting to file their 17 return, it doesn't really matter, because if the offer is accepted, the IRS is going to keep that refund anyways. It's only for the year that the offer is accepted. Next year is different.
So does that mean it applies to 2017? So if they file 2017 2 years from now, They'll intercept that year's refund.
They're still going to take it.
Got it. Okay.
And they wouldn't want to do, yeah, they wouldn't want to do that anyways.
All right. Moving on to Jamie. Jamie's asking, what are the differences between an IRS offer versus a state offer, specifically for New York State?
So we, because of the nature of our practice, we submitted offers, I think probably in most states of the United States. I mean, obviously mostly California, because that's where we mostly are, but we have submitted and had New York State offers accepted. And it's pretty much like the IRS. In fact, even the names of the forms and the numbers of the forms are all the same, except instead of like IRS form 1040, I think it's New York State form 1040, et cetera. And the only difference is where, like I said before, where the IRS will accept an offer, even if it's very low based on ability to pay. California, for instance, doesn't. They want a minimum amount paid. Sometimes it's a percentage of the tax owed. Like I submitted an offer to the California. It used to be the State Board of Equalization, and now it's California Department of Taxation and Finance Administration. And my taxpayer really had nothing. I mean, doesn't even have a bank account. And they came back and they wanted, and this is just an arbitrary number, they wanted 10% of the tax owed, even though the taxpayer really has no ability to pay almost anything. And they were going to borrow from their mother like $1,000. So California is different like that. New York is kind of a hybrid. New York, if I remember, it's based on ability to pay, but they might stretch it out further than the IRS does. Because, for instance, like where the IRS statute on collection is 10 years, California is 20 years. So since they have twice as long to collect, they stretch out the number of months that they figure it out to accept an offer. If you look at their website, they say they want 5 or 6 years, but then when you submit that, then they come back and they want 7 years. So it's going to be disposable income for a much longer period than the IRS. And so that's why it's not unusual for a state offer to be much more than an IRS offer. So even though the taxpayer usually owes the state less than they owe the IRS, the state offer is usually more than the IRS offer.
All right, thank you very much. Moving on to the next question. Eileen has a question regarding partial pay installment agreements. And I think we addressed this already, but let's go ahead and ask the question. Is it correct that if a taxpayer's 10-year statute expires in 1 year and they just entered into an installment agreement, that they will only end up making payments for the remaining year? If I understand this, it is a partial pay installment agreement.
That's correct. If they are in an installment agreement and the statute expires next year, when the statute expires, the installment agreement stops and any liens are released.
Excellent.
And that's right. That's a partial pay.
All right. Next one is Judy. Husband and wife received a 1099 COD for a home that was foreclosed on but did not include it on their original return. The IRS assessed them additional taxes based on that 1099. Can I now amend the return and prove that they were insolvent and have the assessment adjusted yet again? If so, what can I do about stopping active collection from the IRS?
Okay, so what I would do is I would file that amended return by certified mail, and I would have keep proof of delivery, and then if the IRS collects, they're going to do probably one of two things, and that's either a bank levy or a wage levy. And so, like, if they did a bank levy, well, their instructions to the bank is to hold the money for 14 calendar days or business days before submitting it to the IRS. So the money is frozen at the bank before it's submitted to the IRS. So if the taxpayers got a bank levy, I would call ACS with, and I would say, we've amended the return. We filed it. I have proof that the IRS has received the return. And when they process it, we're not going to owe, and ask them to release the funds. And a wage levy too, again, it takes a while for it to be enforced. So again, I would contact ACS and ask them to release the wage levy based on the amended return. Also, you could order transcripts, and the transcript would show that the IRS at least has received the amended return, and that the amended return is being worked. But just remember, an IRS amended return can take up to a year to process. So we just had a case where a taxpayer owed several hundred thousand dollars, but amended the return to include a net operating loss carryback, which would wipe out the tax liability. And we were working with a revenue officer and a settlement officer, and they agreed to refrain from any collection while the amended return was being processed, even if that means that it's going to take a year. So I would get that amended return filed right away. And again, I would file it by certified mail so that you could track it and prove that the IRS received it. And then I would monitor it by ordering IRS transcripts.
All right. Thank you, Norman. Just want to make sure that everyone online is aware. We are maybe about 12, 13 minutes away from ending this. So please go ahead and submit your questions. Time permitting, I'm going to answer or ask those questions to Norman here coming very shortly. So moving on to the next question is, if the IRS issues an SFR and the taxpayer eventually files an original return for the same year, from what date does the collection statute of limitations begin to run? SFR date or file date of return? Please explain.
So I would order the account transcript, because there's different ways they can do it. So first of all, I would need to know, does the SFR lower the tax or increase the tax? I mean, believe it or not, sometimes a taxpayer will file a return that shows that they owe more tax than the SFR did. So I need to know which owed more. But basically, the SFR assessment is based on a 10-year collection statute from the date of that assessment. And then when they file the return, I'd have to look at the transcript, because there's different ways that they do it. So they may, like, for instance, if the SFR original assessment was $10,000, and the taxpayers file a return that show that they only owe for five, then the IRS may just adjust the amount owed and reduce it by $5,000, in which case the original assessment of the $10,000 would be reduced, but the statute would expire 10 years from that assessment. Where other times I've seen it where they zero out the SFR and then put the amount owed on the filed return. And so that amount would be owed 10 years from the date of the assessment of the filed return. So you really need to look at the account transcript to determine how the IRS processed it. And you may have a CSED replaced by another CSED, or you may have two CSEDs, one for each assessment.
All right. Thank you very much, Norma, for that. Moving on to Edward. Edward is asking, I recently was successful in getting CNC status for a client's old and huge tax debt. Unfortunately, client also received a notice of federal tax lien, which is not attached to anything since he doesn't own anything. What form can I use to request release based on hardship? He is a licensed insurance agent, and with that lien, he cannot get appointed with any carrier. He may lose his practice and his only source of income.
So this is a really tricky question, and I'll tell you why. Because the grounds for asking the IRS to release a lien is that it's in the best interests of the government. And so normally, let's just say he wasn't in currently non-collectible. So the argument would be, if you don't release the lien, then he can't keep working as an insurance agent because I think it's because they're bonded and they can't get bonded with a tax lien. And so the thing is, the tax lien would be preventing him from working. And if he's not working, he can't pay the IRS anything. But if he's currently non-collectible, he's not paying the IRS anything anyways. And so there's really no benefit to the IRS to release the lien because he's non-collectible anyway. So I think you have to make a decision, which is more important. Do you want to keep him non-collectible and live with the lien? Or do you want to propose an installment agreement where the IRS will receive something and then argue that they need to release the lien or otherwise they would receive nothing? So you have, in order for them to release the lien, you have to make it advantageous to the government that it's in their best interest to release the lien. And the only way that it's in their best interest is if they're going to get paid some money, and they're going to get paid more money if the lien is released than if the lien is not released. So you're going to have to decide between CNC or releasing the lien. But I don't think you can do both.
All right, Edward, hopefully that helps you. Moving on to one of the online questions here from Gardner. Gardner's asking, on the 433A or an OIC, does a cash basis taxpayer have to disclose accounts receivable or anticipated income the taxpayer may get within the next few months? Do they have to disclose that?
I think yes, because on the 433A, it asks whether, I mean, I guess he must be self-employed. And so it asks if he's, what method he's using, what method of accounting he's using. And if you're using cash, then you would have to, yes.
Yeah, so the sections, I think, 6 and 7 of the 433A go into the self-employment, and they do a mock-up of a Schedule C or a profit and loss statement.
Right.
And one of those questions is the type of accounting method do they use.
Right.
And one of the questions is, do you expect any changes in income?
Any change, either up or down.
Right. So, yeah, that information should be disclosed.
So the answer is yes, unfortunately, you would have to.
Right. Okay, let's see if I can read any more.
So they ask if you do the cash or accrual method.
Right. So let me see if I can ask any other questions.
So maybe you want to try accrual.
Thomas Ungrady, because we were talking about the New York State.
Uh-huh.
He wants to know if we know the requirements for the state of Ohio. I guess we have to do some research there.
You know, we've done Ohio, and I remember doing Ohio, but I don't remember specifically what it is. What I suggest is going on to the state taxing authority's website and looking up offers and seeing, and they'll pretty much spell it out.
All right. And then moving on to the next one, looks like it's Sean. He says, I'm preparing a 433F for my client to try and negotiate an installment agreement. And looking at the financial information, he's paying close to $6,000 in his mortgage. The standard only allows for $3,000 in housing and utilities. what can I expect the IRS response to be?
So what you need to do, because they don't bring it up, is what's called the one-year rule, which says that the IRS will give the taxpayer a year to get his expenses in line with the standards. And so it would be something like his installment agreement would be $1,000 a month for the next year, and then after a year it goes up $3,000, so it goes up to $4,000 a month after a year. And then that year they expect him to either refinance or renegotiate or do a loan mod or sell the house and get something with a lower payment. But you can do something like that. So it's called the one-year rule. And you could always invoke that. And then after a year, there may be other financial circumstances. He may be making less income, or there might be other problems, and you may want to resubmit an F in a year rather than, and renegotiate a new installment agreement.
All right. Hopefully that helps you there, Sean. Moving on to Christine. Christine is asking, can you prove an amount of health care that exceeds the standards, or is the standard for health care the maximum that you cannot exceed?
No, the standard for health care, that's out-of-pocket medical expenses, is given automatically, and it's not subject to proof. But if you want to claim more than the standard, then you need proof. So the IRS is going to allow health care costs of whatever they are, as long as you can prove it, so that you have proof that you have medical expenses that exceed the standards. That's fine. You need to prove that the expenses, and you need to prove that you're making those payments. So, you know, if you're based on your bank statements or doctor bills or whatever, that you have health care expenses that exceed the standards and you're actually paying those health care expenses, they'll be allowable. The IRS doesn't want you to stop taking your medicine or, you know, stop getting your health care procedures because they exceed the standards. So you just have to prove it up. But once you do, they'll allow them.
All right. Thank you very much, Norman. You know what? We're going to go ahead and wrap it up here. I know there's a couple more questions online that we didn't get to, but we're going to add you to the list for next month. And as a reminder, next month's call is going to be on July 3rd, same time, first Tuesday of the month. And we're going to go ahead and close it out now. But yes, thank you very much for attending. Take advantage of that upcoming event, August 1st, and a special promo and a discount. You should have the link and the promo code in the chat box, so take a look at that. I will keep the page open just a little bit longer so you guys can copy that, write it down. But I will also send a reminder email sometime before the end of the day today. Thanks again, everyone. We look forward to next month's call. Please submit your questions ahead of time if you want to make sure that they get answered. And as always, we're here to help you guys grow your practice, make more money, and become the best tax resolution expert you can be. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.